Кремль намеренно вмешался в избирательную
гибридную войну США. Выигрывает Москва.
Глава Кремля умеет добиваться многого.
Путин — это не стратег и не тактик, а геополитический тролль.
У Кремля есть стратегия.
From the hacking to the disinformation to the political interference to the active measures, it's become commonplace to say that Vladimir Putin's Kremlin is waging a non-kinetic political war in the West. And from North America to Europe, it's pretty much conventional wisdom that Russia is supporting the forces of the extreme right and promoting so-called traditional values to drive a wedge into Western societies. But what are the aims of this war? Is it simply tactical? Is it just an effort to weaken the West's resolve? Or is the goal broader? Does Putin's political war in the West actually represent a full-blown civilizational challenge? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior researcher at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there, Brian.
Mark, in an article this week for NATO Review, you argued that Putin's goal is, quote, to deter the West, or at least to divide, distract, and dismay it to the point that it is unable or unwilling to get in his way. In a piece for the Estonian journal Diplomatia this week, I pushed the envelope, as I am wont to do, a little bit farther, arguing that this is nothing short of a civilizational challenge. It's an attempt to undermine, weaken, and ultimately unstick the glue that holds Western civilization together. Now, let me explain how I came to this conclusion. In his book Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, the Israeli historian Yuval Noah Harari has written that it is the human race's ability to tell each other stories, to share collective intersubjective fictions, to believe in collective myths and legend that's made civilization possible. Because according to Harari, things like the state, laws, religion, or even money and corporations truly only exist in our collective imaginations. These things become reified because we believe they're real and we collectively trust in them. This makes large-scale cooperation and thus civilization possible. Now, for the past three centuries, the Western civilization has told a particularly compelling story. It's told a story that individuals have rights and those rights are sacrosanct. It's told a story that government must be held accountable to the governed. It's told a story that all citizens are equal before the law and that political authority must be subordinate to the law. It's told a story that freedom of expression, conscience, and assembly are fundamental. And it's told a story that judiciaries and legislatures need to be independent of the executive. And it's told a story that diverse societies can balance liberty and equality. It's told a story that the sovereignty of small nations is no less sacrosanct than that of great powers. Now, these values only exist to the extent that we believe they exist. There's nothing in our biology that say humans have rights, or that they have to be governed in a consensual manner. These things exist because we believe them. And just like with money, another shared collective fiction that is, after all, just paper with dead people on it, right? Our institutions can become devalued if we stop believing in them. And now, at a time when the West is entering a period of self-doubt, prompted by things like the Iraq War and the 2008 financial crisis, a hostile outside power is making a concerted effort to make us stop believing in our collective story. Russia's doing this with propaganda, disinformation, fake news. It's doing it by backing political forces opposed to Western liberalism, and it's doing it by spreading corruption and creating networks of influence. It's essentially, I argued, attempting to roll back the Enlightenment. Mark, your role here is to keep us in the Enlightenment zone. So you read my piece, I read yours. Let's talk.
Sure. Well, okay, let me just start with, obviously, yes, every social construct is absolutely a product of our consensual common imaginations. And they break down periodically. Anytime you have a run on a bank or a run on a currency, every time you suddenly have a breakdown in law and order, all of these things are signs that, in fact, you know, we shouldn't assume that these consensual things are that sort of solid, but they reassert because of what we want. You want to say?
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I mean, as Timothy Snyder pointed out, we assume that liberalism, that Timothy Snyder, the Yale University historian, has pointed out, we assume liberalism is eternal. And it's not. Liberalisms come and go, and they sometimes reach points of crisis, like in the 1930s, or to a lesser extent, the 1970s. We seem to be in one of those points now. This is really fragile, no?
Well, except this is what I want to say. This is about aspirations, not expectations. I mean, you talked about a sort of 3-century compelling story. I mean, if you think about it, 3 centuries ago, 1717, most of Europe was ruled by monarchies. 2 centuries ago, 1817, we just defeated Bonaparte, but that was when, I'm pretty sure that was when President Monroe was being elected, with the Monroe Doctrine, the notion that, you know, we're a democratic state, oh, but by the way, Latin America is ours, regardless of sovereignty.
And this was also the beginning of the period of the Holy Alliance, which we're going to talk about a little bit.
And then 1917, things had come a long way, so much so that I think it was only 3 years later that American women got the vote. Anyway, I mean, I'm saying that this is actually a sort of...
This is an ongoing story.
Exactly.
It's a process.
It's about a constant constantly changing notions of where we would like to be. Because it's not as if actually in 1717 there was some grand consensus on the need eventually to have universal suffrage. Well, likewise, I think the issue is not just simply about the here and now. The reason why, you know, after the run on the bank, the banking system still survives is because we want there to be a working banking system. And I think that what we have to unpick is exactly the momentary crisis of confidence for a variety of reasons, including in part the fact that our current sort of political systems in many ways are kind of products of a pre-internet, pre-modern connectivities, pre-globalization age. And what do actually people want? And I think the interesting thing, the reason I sort of dwell on that is we actually have to sort of separate what Putin is doing with the Russian people. I mean, the interesting thing is I think there is convergence with actually what the Russian people want, and we can talk about that later. But if we look at Putin, yes, he's supporting the extreme right, but he's also supporting the extreme left when it's convenient. I mean, RT may well be a completely sort of nonsense, little sort of fantasy show, but nonetheless, it's interesting because, again, it shows us something about the very flexibility of this Russian campaign, that you will see them exalting the rights of, you know, Occupy Wall Street people, even though Russia is as predatory a pseudo-capitalism as you could imagine. You know, I mean, essentially, it's not actually that I think Putin cares about what the message is. He cares about the impact. And at the moment, the impact is precisely to be anti-liberal.
And to be disruptive.
Completely.
And to take advantage of this period of temporary weakness.
Of course.
That the West is experiencing, or at least is perceiving itself to experience.
Quite. So I think we just need to sort of distinguish between, as it were, the long-term philosophy behind and actually what he is doing. And I think he's basically targeting all our weak points. And unfortunately, at the moment, the weak points are exactly on these elements of the sort of liberal post-Enlightenment world.
So we have organically this period of crisis that would be going on if there were no Putin.
Yeah.
Right. There would have been a 2008 financial crisis, a subsequent euro crisis, and a subsequent migrant crisis. And before that, we probably would have had the wars of the past decade that have created a lot of mistrust in government if there weren't a Putin. But Putin saw these things, saw an opening, and pounced.
Absolutely.
And whether or not his goal is to undermine Western institutions, first of all, let's get that out there, because your expression of what the goals of the political, we both agree we're that there is a political war going on in the West right now against the West. Your goal, you seem to think the goals are much more limited to basically distracting the West to the point where it doesn't get in Putin's way. And in his way means basically in the way of his desire to have control over the former Soviet space. I see the goals as a little bit more expansive than that. I think that Putin views things like the European Union as an existential threat to this regime. We have this model of governance that, despite its problems, is a transparent, democratic, successful open model of governance that stands in stark contrast to the autocratic kleptocracy we see in Moscow. We have a consensual model of integration. And really, this is like science fiction to Putin, a consensual model of integration. In the EU, little tiny Estonia has the same rights as big Germany. Right. This isn't somebody's empire project. This is a consensual, co-equal model of integration. This stands in stark contrast to the coercive model that Putin is pushing on the Eurasian landmass. So this is also, and on top of all that, it acts as a magnet, not just to Russia's neighbors, but to the more progressive elements inside of Russian society. I think at some point they made a decision that this has to be brought down.
Well, I think the European Union, I mean, 2 points we made here. First of all, we shouldn't assume that they see the European Union, and when I say they, I mean Putin and those close to him, that they see the European Union the way we do. I mean, I'm struck by actually how much things like the EU and NATO, when you talk to a lot of people in Moscow, they have this sense that NATO is basically America's Warsaw Pact, and that the European Union is either sort of America's Comic-Con or more likely Germany's.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that, to take your example, Estonia has the same rights as Germany, but I'm not sure Putin really believes mm-hmm. a lot of that. But secondly, I absolutely agree that in this respect, in many ways, the European Union is a normative challenge to Putin's model. In many ways, it is the sort of the mirror image.
I love how I say existential threat, you say normative challenge. we're playing our roles.
Absolutely. But in this respect, I mean, again, it comes back to the fact that I don't think that Putin cares about the European Union as the European Union. He cares about the European Union insofar as it undermines perhaps part of his sort of ideology, shall I say, at home, and also it attracts other people who otherwise would be attracted, and like a country like Serbia would be a very good case in point, that otherwise he would consider to be sort of part of a sort of a external sphere of allies at the very least. But also, look, the European Union is what creates a bloc where otherwise you got a constellation of individual states. This is why the Russians so much prefer to deal with European states on a bilateral basis, because individually they're stronger than most European states. But if you put the European Union together, economically, even militarily, it's actually a much, much more powerful beast. So I think, again, it's this question of whether it's pragmatism. Because actually, let's say that he managed somehow to completely shatter all of these sort of bonds and institutional structures that hold Europe together and so forth. Ironically enough, that probably wouldn't be very good for Putin.
It would be horrible for Putin, but I don't think he sees that.
Well, maybe so. I mean, but I think it's the same way as, you know, organized crime likes to a certain degree of instability and chaos and certainly high levels of corruption. But on the other hand, also wants there to be a working state because they want to use the banking system. They want there to be ports and railways and all these other sorts of things. Well, ironically, in saying Putin actually also kind of benefits in this respect. So I think what he's trying to do is basically weaken, not destroy. But again, he's doing that, I would say, for purely pragmatic purposes.
So this gets into where I wanted to go with this, of how much of this is belief. How much does Putin believe in this ideological project, and how much of it is just the tactics to keep a kleptocratic regime going? I mean, we've talked many times about these two terms that you coin and I nick all the time, ideological Russia and kleptocratic Russia. I mean, these are often we use these two terms to kind of analyze domestic Russian politics, but I think they're also very relevant in understanding foreign affairs.
Sure.
How much of this ideology is just a smokescreen for a kleptocratic regime, or how much is Putin really trying to recreate the Holy Alliance and party like it's 1815?
Well, I mean, I think that Putin, and again, I mean, what do we know? I mean, this is just purely sort of obviously some
right.
speculation. But I mean, I actually think that Putin at this stage pretty much does believe a fair amount of what he says. That actually, you know, this is all about not just a great Russia, but also one that exactly has to preserve its unique civilizational qualities, which unfortunately, based on the current news, seems to include, you know, beating miners and so forth. Miners with an O, not an E. But at the same time, what really strikes me is this is not an expansionist ideology. I mean, with the possible exception of elements, you know, sort of places that are sort of definitely one would think within the sort of Ruski Mir. But even then, I mean, I don't. If we look at what's going on in the Donbass, for example, they're building kind of, you know, they're building bunkers and supply lines. They're not building churches. More generally, I don't think there's any interest in doing so. I think this is the thing that strikes me. It's a very defensive ideology. It's all about, we are Russians. Nobody gets to tell us how to be. Nobody gets to tell us what to do. Subtext, only me. You know, rather than, this is not like the Cold War days, when there was an ideology that was explicitly aggressive and actually sort of said, we only end when essentially the whole world has been coloured red. Right. This is just more or less, look, the whole world can fall off a cliff for all I care, apart from the fact that who would then buy our oil and gas, as long as we get to be proper Russians. I think that's Putin's approach.
Well, I think there is a part of this that is expansionist, but ironically, it's not the ideological piece. It's the kleptocratic piece. Because I think what they're trying to do, on one hand, is expand this zone of corruption as deep into the West as possible. They certainly want the post-Soviet space to be a, for lack of a better term, Eurasian business space, if you will. That's a polite way of saying a zone of corruption or a zone of kleptocracy. But they want that business model, that cronyistic business model that's based on patron-client relationships and corrupt deals to extend into all of the post-Soviet space. And then they certainly would like to push it into the space of the former Warsaw Pact. We see this actively going on in Central and Eastern Europe. And to the extent that it's possible, into Western Europe. Would you agree that the kleptocratic side of this is expansionistic? No, I don't think Putin's trying to create a czarist theocracy. I do think they're using these tactics to expand their zone of influence. And again, corruption's the new communism. I mean, to expand that, because you can corrupt and you can control, to expand that as far as possible. No?
Okay, but again, I mean, first of all, I think within the post-Soviet space, it's not actually as if the Russians are visiting something new on them. I mean, let's be perfectly honest. You
know, no, the ground like is fertile.
You know, not like the Russians can teach the Ukrainians all that much on that, unfortunately.
But what they are is very aggressive when the Ukrainians try to break out of that, which explains why Russia was so hostile to the association agreement.
Yes, I mean, I very much doubt that was actually in the mind of the Ukrainian government when they first sort of signed
that.
I mean,
government.
I think that's
not that government, that's well, for sure. But that,
not,
but
not entirely convinced about this one. But anyway, but the point is, look, but more generally, yes, of course, the Russians are going to take advantage of any opportunities, and one of them is precisely corruptibility. But again, here's the interesting thing. If you take away all the rules, if everyone is playing the same game, the Russians are suddenly in a very weak position. You know, if the Germans were willing to play by the same rules as the Russians,
right,
they're in trouble.
But the Germans aren't going to play by the rules.
Well, no, exactly. But the point is, this is the Russian model is to have its cake and eat it. You know, and it's like international law. International law should apply to everyone, except us when we don't want it. And likewise, you know, sort of a level playing field. Everyone should have a level playing field. Well, except, of course, that we're going to burrow underneath it and build above it. They are entirely sort of looking not to shatter the whole matrix, I think, but precisely to try and see how they can benefit it by basically cheating. Uh-huh. And you only cheat, or you only get away with cheating if there are rules.
So a world with no rules, it's a be careful what you wish for, you may get it type
yeah,
of situation.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think, look, I mean, so in a way, on one level, we're on a very similar page, which is precisely that this is a very kind of aggressive policy of looking for every chink in the West's, so to say, intellectual and ideological armour that it can use to weaken us. The question is, in a way, quite how it's motivated and quite how far they want it to go. I mean, I think there is the sort of the nuance that we disagree on.
Well, I think they're going to go as far as they can. I think that it's natural for them to push this as far as they can. I don't think they're thinking, a world without rules really doesn't benefit us all that much.
Because they're not going to get that. I mean, they're not so powerful that they can shatter the entire global system. They can deeply undermine it, and mm-hmm. I mean, you know, in some ways, if God forbid, America or the West or whatever was willing to do a deal over Ukraine that basically involved the Ukrainians being told, "Sorry, mates, we've sold you to the Russians," then absolutely, then in a way, the whole fabric, the whole structure of the post-45 order begins to really sort of creak and groan.
Right. And then what about the domestic order? Because we began this conversation talking about the glue that holds kind of Western civilization, Western liberalism together. Is this just a moment of weakness they're exploiting, or can they push this farther, regardless of their intent?
See, is there a risk? Is there a risk? Can. I mean, again, what we really lack is any solid evidence to suggest that the Russians can actually influence opinion all that much. What they tend to do is piggyback on it. And yes, you know, maybe they sort of push it slightly, but you know, we're talking relatively sort of minor elements. It's more that you might say people who are anyway dissatisfied with the status quo now start using Russian talking points almost as the idiom.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean to say that they want to be like Russia or that they think that Putin should come and take over. It's just it's the same way as exactly, you know, going back to the whole business of the sort of Che Guevara T-shirt. Yeah. You can wear the T-shirt without going to fight in the jungle.
Right. So to use Peter Pomerantsev's eternal metaphor, which I love and will continue to use. Now, I read an interesting piece this week by the Russian economist and political analyst Vladislav Inozentsev, in which he makes the argument that we are not reliving the Cold War, but rather that there have been several Cold Wars between Russia and the West. And each of these Cold Wars has been an attempt by Russia to push back on the Western liberalism of that time. And to understand what's happening now, Inozentsev argues that we need to look back to the early to mid-19th century, to the period after the Napoleonic Wars, out of which, of course, Russia emerged as, let's just say, the most conservative of the victors. Back to the period of the Holy Alliance of Russia, Austria, and Prussia. Then, just like now, Russia presented itself as the guardian of traditional values, fighting the spread of liberalism. Then, as now, Russia was concerned with suppressing democratic revolutions, the colored revolutions of this time, crushing rebellions in Poland in 1831, in Hungary in 1848 and 1849. And finally, then as now, when Russia's anti-revolutionary zeal turned much of Europe against it, the tide did turn against the Holy Alliance, it appealed to the Orthodox Christian populations of the Balkans. And Inozemtsev argues that this was essentially the opening bell of a series of Cold Wars with the West that continue to this day. Now, I thought this was a compelling argument. What are your thoughts, Mark? I know you read the piece, too. Did you agree with it? I thought it was a compelling argument.
I mean, I think it's an interesting one. I wouldn't agree because I think it comes down to motivations. You know, my man Nicholas I, he actually believed in all this shtick. I mean, however ridiculous. And his view was precisely that Russia did have this special mission to precisely maintain the status quo. And I think that's a key point. It's maintain the status quo. And he did so even at Russia's expense. Whereas I feel that Putin is entirely instrumental. First of all, he's conservative when it's handy to be conservative. He's revisionist when it's handy to be revisionist. But more importantly, I don't think he actually believes in any of it. He certainly does not do things which are quixotic. He does not do things which are not going to be, in his eyes, in Russian interests. And in that respect, to be honest, I think Putin is actually much more in the tradition of later Soviet foreign policy.
Mm.
You know, I mean, if you look at, I mean, even before World War II, you know, Stalin, who's willing to make an alliance with the West or make an alliance with Hitler, whatever's appropriate. And then subsequently we have, yes, the Soviets supporting national liberation movements because they genuinely cared. No, of course not, because that was the way of undermining the Western empires and Western control. But if you take Afghanistan as an interesting case, the Soviets had no problem at all dealing with the Afghan king and his regime. Then when the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan had their coup and waved their red flags, you know, in Moscow they were saying, oh, God. Well, they probably didn't say God. But, you know, they're actually, I mean, Akhramayev, the general who would later on become chief of the general staff, actually at that point said, we're going to get a real headache out of this. There was no real enthusiasm for it because the dealing with the king had been fine, but they felt they now had to recognize this new revolutionary regime. But the point is, they could work with the revolutionaries, they could work with the king, whatever worked. I think that is really what we're facing with Putin. The thing is that it's because the West has become strikingly coherent and consistent in its liberal values in a way that really has never been the case before. And because Putin is therefore trying to sort of build a position by being the icon for everyone who's unhappy, it's not so much just that he's anti-Western, though he clearly is, but he's trying to create Russia as the anti-West, whatever that might mean.
So what's the end game here? I mean, what is the end game?
I think the end game for him is precisely a West that is so divided, so lacking in self-confidence, and self-confidence is after all crucial, that it basically is unable or unwilling to stop him from doing what he wants in the areas that he regards as kind of Russia's sphere of influence, but also that's not going to be able to impose external values on Russia. And it's not going to question when Russia pushes itself into all the kind of key global discussions.
Not only push their values on Russia, but not even to be a alternative model. I mean, if you're what you're describing, the West kind of ceases to be the West, if or at least the West as we've known it for the past 70
again,
years.
This is assuming that he's successful, and I, for what it's worth, I mean, I don't think for a minute he will.
Nor do I.
But nonetheless, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think you would still have. I don't think he's thinking that Germany is going to change its opinions dramatically. Maybe France could go sort of under a kind of. Maybe there's a third generation of Le Pens who can take over or whatever. But the point is, the West will just simply become a collection of countries rather than the West,
right,
which is something that actually has a meaning and a weight that is greater than just simply the aggregate GDPs of its countries.
Now, we're seeing, finally, in the last several months, a backlash against all of this. We've had three successive elections in Europe that have been won by, for lack of a better term, the pro-Western elements in the West, I guess, if you will. I mean, we've had Austria, the Netherlands, and France. We have every reason to believe the German election is going to go well. What I find curious in all this, because the first rule, if you're in a hole and you want to get out, is to stop digging. And we've seen repeatedly in the French election, when Macron advanced to the second round, and it became pretty clear that he was probably going to win the runoff, that seemed to me to be time for Moscow to cut its losses and reach out to Macron. This is France, after all. It's the most instinctively pro-Russian country in Europe. But they didn't. And even like foreign policy analysts of the caliber of Vladimir Frolov were arguing it looks there are signs that the Kremlin is going to move in this direction. And there were. But they didn't move in that direction. They intensified their attacks on Macron and essentially turned a French president into an enemy of the Kremlin for the first time in my living memory. I don't remember ever a time when a French president came to power, who was going to be negatively disposed toward Moscow. They were in a hole and they kept on digging. Germany is the same thing. I mean, let's face it, AfD is not going to get into government. It's looking increasingly likely that Angela Merkel might be able to form a government without the SDP, which means you're going to have the most, again, hostile to Russia possible coalition emerging in Germany. They're not even going to. There's possible that the SDP won't even have control of the foreign ministry this time. But yet, the hybrid attacks on Germany continue. They don't. Why do they keep? Why do you think they keep digging when they're in a hole here? Because they have lost several in a row now.
I mean, I suggest there's several reasons. One is, it makes sense to stop digging, but that's not a very human thing to do. There's always that one, it's the World War One. One more push, chaps, and then we'll break through sort of fallacy, which is, after all, also something that's very, very visible on the Eastern Front then. Secondly, time and time again, the Russians have demonstrated this. They are technically highly adept, strategically and politically deeply inept. They don't understand democracies. They've shown that. They show that in Ukraine. They've shown that in America. They've shown that now in Europe. In different ways, they keep getting caught by surprise by how democracies work. And I think the thing is that in this context, it's not just about the objective truths of the situation. It is, first of all, how much Putin is truly being told about the detail. This is the point in which I close my NATO review piece on, is actually how Father Spooks essentially are combining to just tell Putin comforting lies. Now, obviously, they're not going to tell him that Le Pen won after all. but the point is, you can always blame it on the Americans or the Germans or something else. Why it's not our fault, boss. Beyond that, though, look, I think what it also points up is actually we have, I think, in the past overstated actually how powerful the Russians have been. We have taken a series of cases in which things went badly for the Western liberal approach, and which obviously the Russians were supportive of, and put two and two together and come up with 17. I think we're now actually coming to realise the limitations. Look, there are places where the Russians can genuinely apply traction. I'm very worried about the Balkans. And I think particularly where you have places with high levels of illegitimacy of the state and weak institutions, and obviously there's several places in Central Europe one could point to, there I think there is scope for the Russians to cause mischief. But in a solidly established, relatively high legitimacy state, yeah, people are happy to complain and feel that things aren't going right and they're worried about globalization and whatever. But that does not actually, I think, manifest on the ground with any sort of major groundswell. Mm. So I think but the very final point I would make is, what else can Putin do? I mean, I think there is this extraordinary policy impasse. Sure, he could have tried to reach out to the French instead of turning Macron into an enemy. And that would have been obviously a very wise thing to do. But in the grand sort of strategic balance, all that would have done is probably maintain the status quo. A status quo which actually isn't that great for the Russians. I think there is almost this sense that they don't know what else to do. They've really burnt their boats. There's no way they can suddenly turn around and say, actually, sorry, it was all a bit of a misunderstanding. We'd love to be friends. To be honest, unfortunately, the West is often desperate to end conflicts.
Yeah.
But I think actually...
And the Europeans in particular.
Yeah, exactly. It's, part of the essential DNA of the EU is compromise and reach sort of resolutions. But I do think that Putin has done too much. There is too much blood and theft and acrimony that's flowed under the river. Well, that's a charming image. To go beyond that. So in some ways, I think he is stuck in just simply trying the old things which are actually increasingly counterproductive.
But as a result, now he has Europe's two main powers very hostile. Now, to push this Holy Alliance 19th century metaphor a little farther, and you jogged my memory by mentioning the Balkans. Because as I said earlier, when the Russian effort to turn the Holy Alliance into the policeman of Europe and to put down the inevitable tide of revolution towards republican government at the time, where did Putin turn? Where did Russia turn? It turned to the Balkans. Turned to appealing to the Orthodox. The Orthodox populations of the Balkans, and we know how that all ended up in the beginning of the 20th century. So you do see a real danger in the Balkans right now.
But I see a different one. I mean, again, if the 19th century in the Balkans, the big threat was the Ottoman Empire. Mm-hmm. That was what for the sort of the Orthodox peoples, right. that was their big concern. And still, you wander around Sofia, and there's streets named after Tsarist generals and such like. That was really important. Now, okay, who knows what will happen under Erdogan? But I don't honestly think we can expect that kind of version of neo-Ottomanism. So instead, in the Balkans, we have, I would say, two struggles. One is, shall I say, sentiment versus practicality. You might have a kind of a historic and cultural affinity with Moscow, but you know where your real economic and political future lies. It lies with Europe. So that's kind of one challenge. And my concern is if Europe fails, if Europe keeps looking as if it's just not interested, then in some ways it hands the Balkans to the Russians in that respect. But the second one is precisely that actually Russia is spoiler rather than anything else. Look at the attempted coup in Montenegro, which I have no doubt was indeed inspired and organised by Russian intelligence, with probably Patrushev, Secretary of the Security Council, behind it. That was not likely to cause some massive realignment of Montenegrin politics. It was to create chaos and to forestall Montenegro joining NATO. Mm. I think this is the thing. Unfortunately, these are countries where Russia can disrupt rather than build. Mm-hmm. And it's likely to do that.
There's indications right now that they're encouraging separatists among the Republika Srpska in Bosnia-Herzegovina.
Absolutely.
Right now. So this is a tinderbox. We saw what this happened there in the 90s. It doesn't take much, and we could have instability in southern Europe again.
Yeah, but again, I think at the risk of sounding sort of unduly optimistic, which is always a dangerous thing when we're talking about the Balkans, I think the position of Serbia is very different now. You have this country that is obviously happy to play the Russians and, yes, please send us some more of your fighter jets and such like. But at the same time, you know, its long-term commitment is to join the European Union. Now, unless the European Union messes up, which is entirely possible, but anyway, that's for us to lose. Otherwise, I think the Serbs, you know, despite all the temptations of little bits of adventurism, when it comes down to it, actually, the prospect of being part of the European community, broadly conceptualized, is actually an amazing one. And again, I think this is one of the reasons why I think the European Union is so frightening for Putin, and this, on that I agree with you. It's because actually what the Serbs want is what most Russians want too. They may not think of it as in terms of joining the European Union or anything like that, but the kind of life that the EU represents for the Serbs, it also represents for Russians.
So this battle between the hearts and the heads that's going on in the Balkans is also going on inside of Russia as well.
Yeah, and this is why, look, I mean, it looks really grim at the moment, but this is why ultimately, as far as I'm concerned, we're winning.
Mm-hmm.
This is precisely because of a certain desperation. The reason why Putin, you know, to go right back to the whole business of motivations and wants to kind of reaffirm Russia's uniqueness and such like, well, you don't have to reaffirm it if it's there.
Right.
He's fighting a rearguard action, in some ways, you know, trying to defend a Russia that never was against the Russia that really people want it to be.
And he's attacking a West that is.
Yeah, exactly, because he thinks that's easier than trying to change Russian hearts and minds.
Well, essentially, and then to keep going back to this, because I really found this Innocence of Peace fascinating, to go back to the metaphor of the Holy Alliance in the 19th century, we know how that one ultimately ended. Mm-hmm. It ended with the triumph of these Republican liberal ideas in Europe that Russia was trying to hold the line against. In the short term, then they had the, you know, three of the most powerful monarchies in Europe with them. Today they have Le Pen and Viktor Orban. So I think there's every indication that we're going to continue that, but not without some effort from the Western side. And that's what I want to talk about in the second half. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at how the West is responding and how it could respond. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior researcher at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical Podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Интересы Запада и России в нескольких важнейших сферах геополитики сейчас
Америка и Запад в глобальной информационной войне с Кремлем.
This year marks the 70th anniversary of George Kennan's seminal article "The Sources of Soviet Conduct," which was published in Foreign Affairs and established the philosophical foundations for the Western policy of containment. Mark, for the better part of the last few years, you and I have been discussing the need to contain Russia's non-kinetic assault on the West, the key word there being contain. We agree that Russia's waging a political war in the West. There are some nuances in our understanding of the goals of this attack. But broadly speaking, we are pretty much on the same page. So how do we do containment in this environment? Because that's essentially, some people are reluctant to use that word because it invokes kind of Cold War ghosts. But this is what we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
We're talking about containment. What would the components of a 21st century non-kinetic version of containment look like?
Well, it's interesting. I know that in one of the Daily Verticals you linked to a piece by Paul Goebel, mm-hmm. in which you were saying that basically in the modern world containment doesn't really work,
yeah.
because of this, of the interconnectivities, and because it's a non-ideological struggle or whatever. But I mean, I think actually that there is significant scope for containment. But I think, in a way, what we have to realize is precisely that because we are now in a struggle which does not have sharply defined battle lines, you know, because this is, after all, something that is played out in interconnected global business, on the internet, you know, in an age in which actually there is nothing kind of distinctive between the peoples, we actually have to think of it in terms of, well, I would say, contain and contaminate. So on the one hand, it's about ensuring that Russia cannot continue to, or anything like the same scale, cause mischief in the West and destabilize the West and undermine values that are essentially sort of the core. But at the same time, containment has to, without moving into the realms of, you know, regime change and so forth, containment also has to realize, you know, has to have with it an understanding that it is not just simply about locking people out. It is rather about saying there are a set of rules, and these are the rules that we think are important, and particularly telling Russians that we think that you're Europeans. I mean, just dwell on that, and then go back to
them with love.
Well, exactly. It's my usual view, but particularly, look, Russians never sit there saying we're a Eurasian power. That's the kind of rhetoric you sometimes get occasionally off and on from the Kremlin and so forth. But actually, Russians, firstly, they think of themselves as European, but secondly, in terms of their nuts and bolts aspirations, you know, when you ask Russians to describe what kind of a country they would like Russia to be, the things they talk about, you know, rule of law, certain degree of prosperity and stability, safety from rapacious you know, regimes and so forth. You know, these are all the kind of things that we recognise as precisely being our own aspirations. And there's little evidence, frankly, that Russians are also that imperialist. Yes, they wanted Crimea back. But, you know, Donbass, Syria, there's no real enthusiasm for any of that. So, I mean,
but they want to be seen as a great power. This is very important to your average Russian.
But I suspect it's important to your average Frenchman and your average Brit. I mean, I think it's a question of, well, what are you willing to pay for it? When they talk about great power, often what they're really talking about is respect. And I think the thing is, one can try and find ways of offering Russians that respect without respecting Putin and the Kremlin. But
see, I don't think it's interesting. You say so does the average Frenchman and so does the average Brit. I don't think most Russians would be, that have this desire to be a great power, would be content with that role. They see that as secondary to Americans. They see the French and the British as American vassals. They see NATO as an American imperial project. And they see, as you put it so eloquently in the first half, they see the European Union as the American Comintern, essentially, which is funny when you think about the reality. But so I don't think they're satisfied with that, because I think they could have had that in the 90s.
They could have had that. They could have had that.
But they wanted more than that. They want to be the Americans.
But when we say who, I mean, ordinary Russians, I mean, do ordinary Russians really care about who gets to do agenda setting at, you know, UN General Assembly? You know, there's a whole realm that actually it matters only to a handful of people. And those are the
handful
people
of people
who,
that matter.
Well, they are the people who matter, and they are our enemies. If we're really going to put it in stark terms, they are our enemies. What we need to do is accept that most Russians are Putin's victims. But anyway, going back to the issue of containment, I mean, I think the thing is, we cannot contain this challenge geographically. This is not about you know, barbed wire fences or, you know, divisions on the border.
No, only in the kinetic piece of it. In other words, putting a tripwire in the Balkans is that
exactly
in the Baltics.
I mean, but the point is, but that does not solve the problem. That solves a small aspect of the problem. You know, what we actually need to do is realize that containment has to be an all of society, all of government thing. So essentially, it is precisely about addressing issues of corruption. And let's be honest, it's by no means only the Russians who use corruption.
No.
You know, it would actually benefit us all to do that. You know, but also, you know, being robust in responding. I think this is the thing. If our values matter, then we should demonstrate that they matter. And for example, when the Russians do things that you know, break our notion of what is acceptable, we should make it clear that there are consequences. You see, we do that with our own people all the time. Someone steals something, we say, well, no, actually, theft is against our values, and therefore we are going to fine you, prosecute you, put you in prison, whatever. So, I mean, I think, you know, we need to be robust with the Russians, but they're very neat, but it needs to be really clearly linked to transgressions. So there needs to be a sense of not, we hate you because you're Russians, and we all, I mean, you know, obviously the propaganda will say that.
Well, yeah,
but
say,
you know,
that
in reality, it needs to simply be, you need to know that when you do these various things, there will be consequences, and there will be serious consequences, because what we've been up to now has been very flabby and erratic, and sometimes we come down hard, and sometimes we avoid it, and so forth. So unity and actually sort of responding to all these systemic challenges, mm-hmm. I think it's going to be absolutely crucial.
I mean, what about the notion of, I mean, because you brought up corruption, and I've been thinking about this a lot and I've had some conversations about it, but if you're laundering money, if you're laundering the Kremlin's black cash, you're damaging the national security of your country and of the West, essentially. This is, I mean, this is happening in, you know, in the city of London. It is happening. It's happening all over Europe. If you're laundering the Kremlin's money, it's getting a little bit close to committing espionage, no? I mean, it's close. I don't want to go quite say, I don't want to quite draw an equivalency, but you are advancing the foreign policy agenda of a hostile power.
I would agree. I think in reality, obviously, it's hard to, for example, really sustain the view that that's that much worse than, for example, laundering money from a cocaine dealer. But, I mean, I think the
but
answer
if you're
is
laundering terrorist money, you can be charged under anti-terrorism statutes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's not so much about the prosecution, though. I mean, I frankly, anything that you want to throw at white-collar criminals at the moment, I'm fine with. Yeah, exactly. Quite. I was actually hoping for mobs with pitchforks. But it's more that the priority that this gets from the state apparatus, and this is something that I was kind of banging on with when I talked about my Crim intern paper for the ECFR, is that actually it is clear that, for example, ordinary organized crime is a bad thing and we need to deal with it. However, organized crime, which is linked to Russian intelligence operations, should be treated as something different, something sort of more serious, something that is absolutely a security threat. So I absolutely agree that we should realize that you might say, you know, money can be laundered, but the intent and the corruption is not. Corruption is always there. And we do have a tendency to sort of more or less, and this is something that we've done with white-collar crime generally, is to sort of assume that once it steps away from the actual scene of the crime, it's somehow less important.
Right.
We can't allow that to happen. But likewise, I mean, there's so many other levels. I mean, it's not just that. It's also about the fact that sort of, you know, from a media regulation point of view, any network tells lies, then that's something that media regulators ought to deal with. However, if it's a foreign network that is clearly working for a foreign government, and I think we could think of one or two, that is telling lies, then again, that should be treated on a sort of aggravated level. It's actually almost like that sort of whenever it is clear that there is statecraft behind it, then things should be taken much more seriously.
Right. And also a lot of these so-called news organizations with very opaque ownership, which curiously enough, you know, tout a Kremlin line. We see the information laundering, kind of a narrative will start in RT and Sputnik. Nobody might believe that to begin with because they know what that is. But then it finds its way into one of these alternative media outlets with opaque ownership, and it gets laundered a little bit, and then it could get picked up by a mainstream media outlet, and then it becomes, you know, fact, at least in the minds of people.
Yeah, I mean, and we can't... I mean, if we start sort of trying to kind of crack down on people essentially just passing on information they hear.
This is perilous territory.
This is moving into precisely how the Russians are, so that you might be sort of, you know, put in prison for liking a Facebook post.
Right, and we don't want to go there.
But exactly, so you have to try and sort of address it at the start point. But again, the funny thing is, look, so much of this is not about creating anything new. It's actually just being about more serious about things that we are meant to be doing already, and we have a tendency to treat lightly because we have got flabby and complacent on so many ways.
We thought history was over.
Well, this is it, and we didn't have anything to worry about, and this is the psychological peace dividend.
Right.
Same way as we wanted to run down our military forces because we could think of much better things to do with the money, well, so too almost psychologically, we have that. Oh, thank God, we don't have to worry about that anymore. And we didn't want to worry about that anymore.
Right. Now, all Western countries have done a lot to shore up their cyber defenses. And I expect that part to continue. That's an obvious component of it. I, again, was just in Estonia. And I really think we can all learn a lot from the Estonians because they are doing all of these things quite well. They have to. It's a matter of survival. But I think we can all take a lesson from them. But there's another piece of this that I think that I've been talking up a lot lately, and it relates to the way I introduced this whole program about the Western story. We've basically forgotten the power of the Western story. We've kind of taken it for granted, and part of it's, and this is a paradoxical thing, because part of what makes the Western story so powerful is its capacity for self-criticism, and that makes it stronger over time. It's a process. But when it's in this period of self-criticism and self-doubt, which almost always we've emerged stronger from, but at that point it's vulnerable and we're being attacked at that vulnerable point now. But one of the things that needs to be done, and there's so much discussion about the information war and how to defend against Russian disinformation, and I think not enough discussion about how to tell the positive Western story again, because this is something where we've fallen behind. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that trying to sort of fight Russian disinformation is, in the main, pointless. We end up with lots of sort of myth-busting and so forth that, frankly, doesn't convince anyone who is already likely to be unconvinced by the official line and so forth. It's about inoculating our societies. And exactly, I mean, a key part of that is the Western story. Look, you know, in the West, we are often hypocritical. We're often whiskey priests. We know what what the West ought to do by its values, but then we think, oh, but the Chinese are so big, or oh, but the Saudi oil, or whatever. We make all kind of compromises. But the point is, we do have a clear sense of a moral compass, and we do try. We do try and right. do things by a certain way. And it, absolutely, that's part of inoculating ourselves, is a willingness to actually demonstrate leadership. And this is something that I found really heartening about the French elections. And I realize that sort of my English half sort of should bar me from saying this. I think in this respect, the French elections were actually quite inspirational.
I thought so too.
Not just because we actually had a very sort of clear battle line between a sort of a nativist, small-minded vision of the world, but actually, you know, Macron was willing to really go out there and solidly articulate, not just a pro-European line, but a pro-liberal values line
and a pro-transatlantic line.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought that was really nice, because we have lacked that kind of strong leadership. We have got, in too many cases, countries that are led by mediocrities who are more interested in what the focus group says or what the careful accounting of parliamentary seats says, rather than that sense of, well, what do we believe in?
Yeah.
And it's our job to convince the people of what we believe in, rather than to try and work out what message we think will go down best.
Yeah, no, I felt the same way. I was to say I was overjoyed on the night of the second round of the French election is an understatement, because precisely for the reasons you said, Emmanuel Macron really articulated what we all believe in but have been afraid to say for so long, and he won with 2/3 of the vote. Mm-hmm. So my hat's off to the French on that one. Before we wrap it up, there's one thing I did want to touch on, and this came up at a StratCom conference I was at yesterday. We were talking about where I explicitly went back to the 1947 analogy, and a very sharp question from the audience came out about making the contrast between now and in 1947. Then we had a consensus about the threat. We had a consensus within Western societies and a consensus among Western societies about the nature of the threat and the need to do something about it. Then we had an all-of-government approach in place, working. And then we had utter confidence in the Western story at the end of the Second World War. We don't have these things now to that degree. Now, a historian might argue with me, we really didn't have all of them quite yet in 47 yet.
But curses, you got there before me.
But certainly by the early 50s we did. Certainly by the early 50s we did. Are we moving towards this point now?
Well, it's difficult, because I mean, I certainly wouldn't want to see the shades of Senator McCarthy.
No,
unfortunately, that's part and parcel of that kind of particular model, because exactly, it came out of World War II and a sense of true existential threat.
Yeah, but does it necessarily have to go to Senator McCarthy? Can it stop with George Kennan?
Well, of course. I mean, I'm saying this is. I'm just slightly concerned about sort of raising that particular thing.
I
mean,
I am too.
Because what we need to do is appreciate that it's about two things. One is precisely, yeah, it's protecting ourselves. And that means exactly working our way through our current sort of Western heebie-jeebies about what are we here for and such like, and working out how we can sort of, you know, move forward in a way that actually sort of responds to the challenges of the new world. I think people are thinking about that. Secondly, it's about just the nuts and bolts of just ensuring that the Russians are in less of a position to cause trouble. And we are definitely getting there. You know, you mentioned the cyber issue. I mean, you know, that's just one example. But I think that there are a lot of lessons being learned, and not as fast as I'd like, but nonetheless, I think, and not certainly not as, you know, as unified a way as I'd like, but nonetheless, we are moving in the right direction. But the third sort of crucial element is this, is precisely, it's not just about dealing with the immediate problem. It's also about where's Russia going to fit in the future? Is it just simply, we'll just lock it away so it can't bother us, and then who cares what happens to it? And this is why I'm going to go back to this business of actually how we have to kind of be positioning ourselves. Because as I said, from my point of view, most of Russians don't really want to be locked out. There is a kleptocratic elite, and frankly, even most of the elite, as long as they still get to kind of keep their money, they have no problem with Western democracy and so forth. That's where they wanted to send their kids and everything else. But the real stumbling block is Putin. And here's just a sort of lupus round. Here's one of the differences between Putin and Nicholas I.
I knew you were going to go there.
I aim to please. Nicholas I, I mean, you know, in his final years, was seriously contemplating emancipating the serfs. This absolutely crucial reform, which really sort of, you know, basically broke the old patrimonial
structure. Which his successor did.
His successor did. Now, ultimately, Nicholas I didn't dare. You know, he was too worried about the political consequences. He thought, rightly, that it actually would be a period of extraordinary sort of instability if he did that. But nonetheless, there was a man who was actually kind of willing to say, look, actually, history is not on our side. We need to think how we can move forward. The problem is, I don't see any signs of that in Putin.
No, absolutely. Quite
and
the opposite.
That is why, I mean, I think what we have to accept is that so long as Putin is in the Kremlin, this is what we face. This is why we actually need to have all these structures in place, these reforms and so forth. After Putin goes, whether it's in 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, whatever, then the situation is likely to be very different. But the point is that we have this weird situation now in which actually most Russians don't really, in my opinion, believe in this ideological struggle. Even people within the elite just simply have to play along with it. But so long as Putin is committed to it, so long as Putin is telling his guys this is what you've got to set out to do, we are stuck in this conflict.
Right. Right. And on one last note, it's I had an interesting panel discussion in Tallinn where I was about Russia's values, essentially. And while we were talking about what the values the Kremlin was promoting. But then I decided to bring into discussion Navalny's offering another set of values. And one of the panelists said, it was very interesting. He said, what Navalny is saying is, yes, we can. Stop telling us we can't be European. Stop telling us we can't live in a democracy. Stop telling us we can't live with the same dignity of Westerners and of Europeans. Yes, we can. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
I thought it was really compelling.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, Navalny's strength, why Navalny is so damn dangerous for the Kremlin is because Navalny brings a message of hope. You know, what authoritarian regimes want is for people to have no hope, no belief that things can improve. Navalny's coming along and saying, actually...
Yes, we can.
Actually, exactly. Yes, we can. I mean, and even, and this is part, I think, of his brilliance in actually targeting Medvedev rather than Putin. You know, a target that people feel actually is achievable,
right,
rather than just some sort of, oh, we're going to completely sort of tear the whole regime down. So, yes, he is saying that. And to link this back to what we were saying about the European Union and the West generally, that's exactly what also has been lacking in Western narratives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is that sense that we feel pessimistic. We feel a lack of optimism about what we can do. We do not feel that we are masters of our own fate as nations, as individuals, or whatever.
Used to.
Exactly. And we need to recover that. And whether that means changing institutions to sort of more effectively reflect that, or just simply precisely having leadership to the point that says, for God's sake, what are you sort of faffing about? Actually, you know, there are huge opportunities to shape the world in which you live. So in this respect, yeah, I mean, in some ways, well, in some ways, we could deal with a few more Navalny's on this side.
Well, as you said, Emmanuel Macron seemed to be one of those. Angela Merkel seems to be running on this kind of a platform in Germany. So I think we do have this.
So this is why history is on our side, because there are going to be more Navalny's.
I love it when we can end the podcast on a positive note, because that's all we have time for today. So we'll wrap up. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior researcher at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks, Mark, for an enlightening discussion and keeping me in the enlightenment zone.
Fun as ever.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFURL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.